Robert Kim, interviewed for the Oral History Collection by Daisy Chun Rhodes. The interview is taken on May the 26th, 1994. Because of your mother's background coming from Korea, could you please tell me everything you know about her prior coming to Hawaii and her occupation as a midwife, where she got her education?
She was a nurse at first in Korea, and then she quit being a nurse because she was getting tired of people dying in the night. And before they died, they used to call her, and this is what she told us. And when she'd go over there, they'd hold her hands and they'd die, and she didn't like that. So she turned to teaching school, and that's when she's from the North Korea, and when she started teaching school, she went down to South Korea in Seoul, right where my grandparents lived. And that was when my grandparents were kind of frustrated because my father was in Hawaii and he wasn't married, and he was close to his 50th birthday and stuff like that. So they showed my mother a picture of my father when he was much younger, and you know, asked her if she wanted to get married to him. And so she decided she would, and she did. So she came to Hawaii, and she got married to my father. Mm-hmm. Of course, when she came to Hawaii from the boat, she looked around. She couldn't find this young man. And she looked around real close, and then she found, later on, saw an old man that looked something like a picture that she had. And she was so disgusted, she wanted to go back to Korea. But since she was here, she went down and she met him, and sure enough, that was him. Mm-hmm. And they got married. And then while they were married, my mother made, got to be a midwife, and she helped all these Korean women that were giving birth.
Now, the Korean women who were giving birth and your mother's helping them, where was this taking place?
Mostly in the plantation. Eva, she even went as far as Waihewa and places like that. And I remember when I was a small boy, about 3 to 4, 5 years old, 3 to 4, one day she didn't know, a woman was giving birth in Honeyuli, which was on the outskirts of Eva. And I used to follow my mother all the time, all over the place, wherever she went. And she didn't know I was sitting right there in the room when the woman was giving birth. And I saw all the baby come and everything else. And after she delivered the baby, and then she turned around, she saw me sitting right across looking at the whole thing. And she said, I wasn't supposed to be there. So she gave me a balloon and told me to go outside and play. But it was, that was all over and done with. Mm-hmm. And I saw the whole thing from start to finish.
That's a very remarkable experience that you had.
Yeah.
Did your mother carry, was she on call, and did she serve all ethnic groups, or specifically Koreans?
Specifically the Koreans. As far as I know, it was strictly Koreans, because she wasn't on call or anything like that. Whenever a woman was ready to give birth, they usually called my mother to come assist. Mm-hmm. And she used to go over and do that. She did a little of everything anyway, but I remember when I was a little boy in the late 1920s, I think she was the first woman in Hawaii to sell kimchi to people, because she did it in about 1926, 27. And I remember I used to go around picking up mayonnaise bottles from different people's places, and she used to make the kimchi in a big tub. And I think she sold it for about 35 cents a bottle, mayonnaise bottle. And she couldn't make it fast enough because it was all sold every time.
And this was at the plantation?
At the plantation, Ebba Plantation. And she also took in laundry. You know, she got these, these Filipino plantation workers whose clothes was real dirty, black with the soot from the burning cane. And she used to charge them $3 a month. And she used to work she used to get up about 1-2 o'clock in the morning and start ironing and stuff like that, making lunch for my father. After Queens left forever, he couldn't be a priest and a minister anymore because he only spoke Korean. And so he had to work for the plantation then. And when he worked for the plantation, he worked as a, he used to drive a mule picking up garbage. And he had two Filipinos loading it on, and he was on top of the mule.
So this was in Ebba?
In Ebba Plantation.
So from a minister, he became, he took care of the trash for Ebba Plantation.
Yeah.
How old was your father when he stopped being a minister?
Oh, let me see. That was in 1930, 31. So, I guess he was roughly about 60 years old.
Your father's ministry, you had mentioned to me previously that you learned about it much later in life. Can you tell me all that you did learn about your father's ministry, which may include his education and where he was educated?
Well, as far as I know, all he ever did before he left Korea was he was a scholar. All he did was study all day long. And the reason he left Korea was the Japanese soldiers came to Korea, and the Korean scholars those days, they had long hair tied up in a bun with a small cap on the top and a long bamboo pipe with a book, and they had something like almost like a dress, white dress, and all day long they'd be walking all over the town and be reading and studying. And that's what he used to do. And then when the Japanese came over to Korea, what they did was they grabbed a hold of him, they cut his hair, broke his pipe, and did all kinds of things that got him so mad that he walked all the way from Seoul to Busan, which is a couple of hundred miles, got on the first ship that left Korea, and it came to Hawaii, so he was here in Hawaii. That's how we got to be in Hawaii.
Then after your father came to Hawaii, and because he was a minister, which denomination was he affiliated with?
With the Methodist.
And that was in Ebba also?
Yeah. He started off, when he first came to Hawaii, he was in Kauai, Koloa, and while he was over there, he got to be a principal of the Korean school. And, you know, little things like that. And it was all because of the education he had in Korea. And after being a principal in the Korean school in Kauai, when he came to Ebba, he was in Kahuku for a while, and then he went to Ebba Plantation. And from there, I guess he got to be a minister, because I was born in Ebba. And
was his ministry applied also at Ebba, and did he have a congregation, and did he perpetuate the language that you know of?
Yeah.
How did he do all of this?
Well, he had the church, and every Sunday, they had a lot of single Korean men from Korea that were worked in the plantation, and every Sunday my father was short and stocky. He was a big, he was a strong person. The single people would all have to come to the Korean church. And after church, they used to get drunk and they used to fight and things like that. My father, I know one instance where he grabbed two guys that were fighting and he just cracked their heads, knocked them out, and he carried them, he carried both of them. And he had me go over to open the door for him. And he just dropped them on their beds, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Nearly everybody that had anything new over there at the plantation always brought it over to our house.
So you were essentially brought up with the entire Korean congregation and the Korean community then, mm-hmm. in Evo. As children, were all of you required to take language or to speak Korean in the home? And if so, how did your parents require you to conduct the language and your sense of communication with them?
Well, my father never understood English, so whenever he spoke to us, we had to answer him in Korean. And, you know, sometimes we use some English words, some pidgin English, but he didn't understand English all the way until he died. Whereas my mother, she understood English. She spoke English, pidgin English. In fact, she got to be a naturalized American citizen. My father didn't. And they were divorced in 1932. And my father died in 1943. My mother died in 1963, 20 years later.
Now, tell me about yourself. Your perceptions of your parents certainly instilled many values regarding things that are Korean. And I'm sure that there are phases that you went through where you felt involvement with them as being Korean. Can you tell me a little bit about that, particularly their sense of nationalism and national pride because of the situation in Korea during the years that we have been discussing?
Well, when we were in Eva Plantation, in our house, in the living room, he always had pictures of the Korean king and all these things always up on the wall. And from my understanding of it, he came from a sort of a royal family. So he always used to brag about Korea and stuff like that. And I never believed them about the fruits in Korea were the best in the world, you know. And until I went to Korea in 1946. And that's when I found out the fruits were good, very good.
In our previous talks and in letter writing, you mentioned that you had extensive experience in Korea as a result of your occupation there. And also that you did search out your relatives. Can you tell me about who you found and your relationships and what you have learned about your family in Korea?
Oh, I found out that the Koreans have funny kind of customs. For one thing, when I first met my father's younger brother, he had only one brother, I guess, but the brother was younger than he was. I didn't realize that the Korean custom was that regardless of how old you are, you don't smoke in front of your elders. And I offered my uncle a cigarette, and he said, no, 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 and he just went away. And I offered my cousin, his son, a cigarette, and he also refused, and I knew they both smoked. But later on, I found out when my uncle was gone, my cousin told me, he says, Korea, you're not supposed to smoke in front of the elders. And, you know, Another thing I found out was the eldest son of the eldest son of the eldest son was supposed to be running the family or taking care of the family. And my father was the eldest son, and I was his eldest son, so they expected me to come to Korea, live, and take care of the family. And I said, nuts, the hell with it. I didn't want to stay in Korea. And in fact, I met a Korean girl when I was there in the army, and I would have been married to her, excepting for the fact that I got hurt in Korea, and they shipped me, the army, if you were in the hospital for more than 3 months, they ship you back to your home of record, to a hospital close to your home of record. And so when I came back to Hawaii, I met my wife and got married to her. That was the end of that. When I wrote to the girl in Korea, I told her that I was married. That was the last I heard of her. But back in 1973 or 1974, when I was in Okinawa, I met this Korean doctor and his wife. We had dinner at his house, and I found out from the wife that she was a classmate of this girl. And this girl had never gotten married. And then when she was going to college, she says she was from Iwa. And she says this girl had, they all thought that she would be the first one to get married. But she never did get married. And they were wondering why.
Maybe they were waiting for a first son to come back.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things you said is that your father said he was of royalty.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about this?
No,
and if so, how? What was the hearsay on that even?
No, I have no idea, excepting that, from what I understand, you see the Kims are divided into different clans. Although there's about, it seems like 3 out of 5 Koreans are called surnamed Kim, they're not related, most of them. And the clan that my father belonged to, the Koreans called Yangbans, the Andong Kim. And all the time I've been to Korea, I've met only one person that belonged to the Andong clan. And I know from what I've said, the Andong clans are, supposed to be of the elite.
Well, obviously, from what you say, your father was a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that he instilled a sense of scholarliness in you as a value to perpetuate throughout your life?
My parents both, most Orientals are like this, I guess. They always instill in the kids the fact that they should go to college. Of course, in my case, I couldn't do anything because although I wanted to be a doctor when I was young, when I got out of high school, I didn't have any money to go to school. And so, and besides that, my father was divorced from my mother, and my mother was living in a plantation with nobody working the plantation, so she sent me over to Molokai to work and so that she could stay in the plantation house. And I worked over in Molokai until the war started. And when I came to Hawaii, Oahu, after the war started, and worked in Navy Yard, and I saved money to go to college. But after I got drafted in the army, I said, to hell with it, and I lost all my money in crap games.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell me what your plantation life was like in Molokai. You said your father sent you to Molokai?
Right, to work for the pineapple plantation.
So your mother could have her rights in Ewa.
No, so she could stay in the plantation house in Molokai.
In Molokai,
yeah.
I see. So it was a security move that
was made for her,
which you participated in. But could you tell me what it was like in those days, since it was getting towards 1930, in the late 30s, how you worked in the plantations there and what your jobs were And what your pay was, for instance?
16 cents an hour, and I worked as a laborer. And eventually I worked up to about 35 cents an hour in 1941. And then after the war started, I came to Honolulu and worked down the Navy Yard. You know, I was making about 75 cents an hour or something like that, and I ended up with about $1.50 an hour, which was a lot of money.
Yes, especially after the income you earned at the pineapple plantation. But what kind of labor work did you do, and how long a day was it for you? How long a week was it for you with those wages?
Well, we worked for about mostly about 40 hours a week, 8 hours a day, and did everything in the pineapple fields, like digging weeds, or you know, sometimes you work on contract, we're picking pineapples and crating them. And I never did get to plant pineapple, but that's another contract they used to have. And well, when I was young, I couldn't stand that type of work. So usually I'd have a lunch can and go out in the pineapple fields with a pineapple truck, and then by the time 10 o'clock came around, I ate all my lunch already. And I used to, after that, walk back to the to home. Never did last 8 hours. So I never did make much money in the pineapple fields.
Ah, I see. Now, I just wanted to backtrack back to Eva. Then your father really never went out into the pineapple fields to do the same kind of work that you did.
No.
He was simply the garbage man, as you say.
Well, Eva was a sugar plantation.
I see.
And all I know is he used to drive the mule around. And at the end of the day, he'd have the mules wade through the water and take care of the mules, you know, their shoe, the shoe on the feet and stuff like that. And then take off the harness and everything else. I know I used to go with him when he, at the end of the day, several times, and I used to see that.
How many brothers and sisters did you have, and what was life like in the home and in the community in Eva and in Molokai?
Well, in Eva, you know, at the time my parents were very strict about, you know, whenever they call us, we couldn't say what or anything like that. We still have to answer in Korean. Yeomni and Yeowaji and stuff like that, where, you know, Koreans, you know, the language itself is so that they have different ways of speaking to different people. Like the parent speaking to the child speaks one way, and parents speaking to some other parent would speak another way, and then parents speaking to the teachers or somebody up above would speak another way. So there's three different ways of talking. And most of the Koreans in Hawaii, after the war started and we got to be interpreters and things like that, we only learned to speak to our parents, so we were speaking up to people. And we had to learn how to adjust to that. Most of the Korean kids that knew Korean, they had a hard time.
So you're talking about when you went to Korea, you had to make that adjustment, not here.
Yeah, not here.
I think that's very, very interesting. Now, because your father was a scholar and was a teacher of the language, did he teach you Korean?
Not really. My mother was the one that was a teacher. She was the one that, I remember when we were kids, I had two older sisters that when they were going to school, elementary school, she used to teach him math, and we used to have a blackboard in our house in the living room. And most of the time I'd be sitting on my father's lap. I was only about 3 or 4 years old at the time. But I still liked math even then. And every time they'd have, she'd put up a math problem and my two older sisters couldn't answer, she'd always turn to me and say, "What's the answer?" And I'd give it to them.
So you had two older sisters, and did you have any brothers?
Not that I knew of, but according to my mother, I had two older brothers that died.
I see.
In fact, two of them died. One of them died right after he was born, and the other one died not long after he was born.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of birth and death, who helped your mother when she had children? Do you know?
That's the reason one of my brothers died. There's a woman that supposed to help my mother. You know, she was a midwife, supposedly. But when the child was born, she bathed the child in cold water and the child died.
I find that rather remarkable. Your life after you left Molokai, I'm very interested in the war years, World War II, and how you think it impacted you in terms of becoming either closer or farther away from being Korean.
Well, the thing that really got our family away from the Korean was the fact that my mother was a picture bride, and she was the first picture bride in Hawaii to get a divorce. And the Koreans ostracized the whole family because of that. Consequently, and besides that, we never stayed near Koreans after that. And not one of my brothers or sisters, brother or sisters, I have only one brother, was married to Korean. Every one of us got married to a different nationality. In fact, most of them, my older sister and one of my younger sisters got married to Japanese. My brother has gotten married to an Okinawan girl. And then I had two sisters married to Caucasians. And of course, my wife is Chinese Hawaiian.
Now, about the divorce, do you know the circumstances under which the other Koreans held a distance? You seem to imply that there was a distance between the other Koreans, either of the community of Eva Molokai, to yourself. Do you know what caused that, other than the fact that your parents were the first to become divorced? Do you know the causalities and all of the surroundings, and what were your mother's and father's attitudes after that about their fellow Koreans, their fellow brothers and sisters?
Well, my mother could care less. She didn't care. And she fell in with the community wherever she was, and she adjusted herself to whatever was up. But my father still had Korean friends, and he only spoke Korean, so he had to have only Korean friends. He couldn't do anything else. Whereas my mother, she spoke Pidgin English, and she could get along. And the Koreans, they looked down on us because of the fact that my folks were divorced. And of course, my younger brother and sisters, they didn't know any better because they never lived with Koreans. Where my older sisters and myself, we're the only ones that know any Korean at all. And we were affected more than anybody else.
Then, when you went to, you indicated that you had been in Korea for a number of years. Did you learn the language then?
No, I learned it from my mother. And as a child, you know, that's all we spoke, Korean. Mm-hmm. And I never learned anything in Korea. In fact, the only thing I learned in Korea was that a lot of Korean that my folks taught me was I was outdated. They didn't use the same words anymore. The language had changed quite a bit. For an example, I remember my mother used to call bread bangtok. Now in Korea, all they say is pang. And then we used to call toilet tukan. Mm-hmm. And now they call it hwajangsil, mm-hmm. which is different. And they have many different terms that they use right now. Then, of course, some of it, it's just a... they just get the American words and they don't have any Korean equivalent, so they use the Korean American words and just add a little to it to make it Korean.
I understand, because I've experienced things like that also. One of the things that interests me and historians and social scientists have said about the Koreans here in Hawaii and Koreans in America is that they did have a nationalistic attitude because of Korea's annexation by the Japanese. Did this in any way have an influence in your family life? And if so, can you tell me what your observations were regarding your parents and their attitudes towards their feelings and outreaching towards Korea Koreans?
You can just imagine how my father felt, because he hated the Japanese with a passion. And when my older sister was going with a Japanese fellow who she eventually got married to, my father almost killed her. And I remember those days, I was just a young teenager. I used to play football and things like that. And one day when I was coming home, I heard my sister yelling. And when I went up into the house, he had her by the hair and was pounding her head on the floor. So I just ran and dove right into my father, and he was so astonished by my actions. I never did anything like that before, that he let my sister go. And while I was on my father, I just told my sister, get in the room and lock the door. Of course, that was kind of really idiotic, because my father was strong enough to just break the door if he wanted to. Of course, he didn't, but there was just a way of getting away from anymore. And my sister got married to a Japanese guy, and they're still married.
You indicated that your father had the pictures of the king. Was it the last king, King Yi?
I have no idea.
Did he show other symbols on the wall? Like, did he have a Korean flag and pictures of martyrs?
Oh yeah, I knew about the Korean flag, because they had pictures of the Korean flag. And had a king and the queen on the, of course those days they had the men carrying the on their shoulders. What do you call those things?
The palanquin.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but they had a whole batch of men carrying the king and the queen on these things, on these little carriages, like, instead of animals, it was men.
And you had a picture of the king?
It was a painting, more or less.
It
was sort of painting, like, it wasn't pictures, because that was so many years ago. I don't think they had any cameras those days. Mm-hmm. But we had several of them. I don't even know what happened to those pictures, because after the divorce, I don't know what happened. And when my father died, he had a hell of a lot of books. And I didn't know anything about the value of those books, all in Korean. So at the cemetery. What we did was we started a fire and just burnt the whole thing.
I see.
And
so he had saved all of his scholarly books in all those years.
But you see, the thing was, he died of a skin disease. The doctor said they had no record of anything like that for in the last 25 years. They only had about 3 or 4 people with the same kind of disease. And so, it was just eating up his skin. He had the sores all over his body, and his eyes were, you know, where the tears came down was a big hole. And it really looked bad, so he never kept anything of his stuff. He just burnt it.
I see the reason why. Otherwise, I'm sure you would have seen value in it and probably tried to turn it.
Of course, no. I don't think we knew the value of this stuff. Because if we did, we would have kept it anyway.
Well, that's very fascinating. Tell me about the things that were Korean in your life regarding your daily activities, your food, whether or not there were customs that you had traditionally adhered to. And then one of the things I would like to know is just how Korean do you feel now?
Well, when we were little, we always had to respect our elders. I mean, our parents, you know, they demanded that we respect them. And we spoke Korean to our folks and everything else. And of course, I used to speak more Korean. I knew more Korean then than I do now. But Korean is a very difficult language. You can forget it very easily. And although I've been to Korea over 24 times since 1946, I'm still trying to learn Korean. There's a hell of a lot I don't know. I can understand a lot of stuff they say, but if they speak too fast, I don't understand a word they're saying.
What about Korean songs, Korean dance? Did your parents, because of their feelings toward Korea, particularly your father, sing them to you or have recitations that were of importance to him that he wanted you to learn because he was a scholar?
No. My mother used to sing some, but we never did get to learn anything Korean. Songs or anything like that, because by the time my folks were divorced, I was only 10 years old. And up to that point in time, my mother used to do all the cooking and everything else, and she was a tremendous cook. I liked the way she did things, and I never had it after I was 10 years old, because we always lived away from places, and I used to eat in a restaurant or something like that. Since then, I've been making my own Korean dishes like kimchi and things. And
are these recipes or methods that you make kimchi learned from your mother?
No.
Because it's
just the idea. I knew how she was making them when I was a little boy, and I just. The way I thought she made it. Only thing was I finally found a fish sauce that the Korean markets had to make the kimchi, and I've been using that. And now the kimchi, I noticed a lot of people like it quite a bit.
Very good.
In fact, a lot of people ask me to sell it, and I don't want to.
You're not going to take after your mother and
make
kimchi and sell it.
I don't like to sell things anyway. I used to be a salesman, and I don't care for it.
Okay. Well, I have to turn this over, so hold on a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is a continuation of interview with Albert Kim. Albert, Tell me a little bit about the educational process that you have proceeded through your life. I noticed that you have had an incredible amount of education. What motivated you?
Well, my parents, more than anything else, they wanted us to have a lot of education. Education was an important item in their outlook on life. I didn't have anybody to tell me how to do things from the time I was 10 years old, because my father didn't understand English for one thing, and then I didn't understand enough Korean to talk into depth with him. So all the courses I took from high school was because I wanted to take the courses. Like, for instance, I took algebra for one semester, and I found it was so simple that I quit taking algebra. I quit taking any math courses. And it's not because I couldn't do it, it's because I thought it was too simple and I was wasting my time. And that was the biggest mistake I ever made, because when I was in the Army in Chicago, they were giving a course, a night course in calculus. And I applied for it, and they asked me if I had any trigonometry or geometry. I didn't have any. And he asked me why I want to take calculus. And I said, oh, well, you know, I intend to go to college, and then I wouldn't have to take the course again. So they said, well, you have to pass this exam before you can take calculus. So I took the exam and I passed it. So I took calculus, night course. And while I was taking the night course, I ended up in hospital for a couple of weeks before the final exams, because I had the epileptic seizure. And after I got out of the hospital, I had to take the final exam. I still did pretty good. I had a B. And the instructor from the University of Chicago that taught that course was, in my estimation, the most outstanding instructor I ever came across. He was young, and he knew how to answer questions whenever you had him on calculus or any math subject.
How did your parents instill the idea of the importance of education? Many parents would say, oh, you must study hard, you must go to school each day. How were these passed on to you so that it remained within you so much that you continued on all the way into even beyond age 40 with your continuation of school? What was it that your parents did and said to you directly that influenced you so greatly?
Well, it was their way of making me want to do different things that could only be done by having a college education. One of the things that I was pretty much aware of was the fact that if I'm going to spend some time working 8 hours, I might as well get the most out of it. In other words, why work for $1 an hour when you can get $20 an hour?
I see.
And the only way you can get $20 an hour is if you had a college education and was in some field where there was in great demand. And that's what I was working for.
So education really became a force in which, ironically, caused a separation of your ways. You went your way because of education, and your parents stayed behind and watched. Can you tell me a little bit of how you think your mother felt when you continued on and directed yourself towards your educational process?
I have no idea how my mother felt, because I guess she was happy I got a degree, but I never stayed with her. I never lived with her from the time I was 10. So I never did see her too much of her from the time on. And my father, he passed away at 43, so I didn't go to college till 56. So it was way after he passed away.
When you were 10, how is it that you didn't see your mother?
Well, I stayed with my father.
Oh, you stayed with your father.
Yeah.
Then your father had the great influence of impressing you with education, I assume.
Well, he didn't have the time of day to talk to me. He was busy trying to earn a living, because he wasn't trained at all for anything outside of Korea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If he was in Korea, he might have made a pretty good go of himself, but in Hawaii, he didn't even speak English, let alone understand what was necessary for him to do anything.
So you were your own self-motivator, is essentially
yeah.
what you're saying.
Essentially, I was doing things my own. I remember when I was going to intermediate school, I used to get into all kinds of trouble all the time. And we used to have 8 o'clock curfew for kids under 16, and I got picked up by the police for being on the streets after 8 o'clock several times.
That was because of war years?
No, this was way before the war years.
Before the war
yeah.
years.
Because during the war years I was over 18, I was about 20 some odd years old. But this was, you know, prior to that, up to 1937, I was, you know, they had that rule where 16 and below couldn't be out on the streets after 8 o'clock. They stopped that during the war years.
I see.
And I think they should keep on doing it again. That's where you get a lot of trouble right now.
Tell me then how you feel the depression impacted upon your life.
I wasn't even aware of it. Of course, when I lived with my father in the 30s, I used to do all kinds of stuff. I used to hike after school from intermediate school all the way up Nuono Valley and knock on people's door, ask if they wanted yard work done and stuff like that. And then I used to sell newspapers. And selling newspapers, I used to earn more than those days, married men used to earn maybe $1 a day for working 8 hours. I used to earn more than that, maybe $1.50 to $2 a day working about 3 hours selling newspapers.
What year was this?
In 1933-34. And what I used to do was I used to save my money in shoe boxes, and whenever I needed clothes, I used to go down to the tailor shop and have it made to order. And if I needed anything, well, I used to take it down to Nuono Avenue and buy shoes and whatever I needed. Of course, I never used shoes until I was in high school.
So you walked barefoot until high
yeah.
school. And when you were a paper boy during that time period, you saved most of your money, is what you're
no,
saying, except for when you needed
I saved it in a shoebox, and then when I needed anything, I used to spend it to cover that hole.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, after a couple of years, my, what do you call, the seizure stopped. And since that time, 77, 78 on, I stopped taking phenobarbital dalampin.
I can see why that would be a turning point in your life.
Yeah.
Yes. One of the things that I would like to ask you now, after all of these years and with all your experiences, some people say, are you Korean? Are you Korean American? Are you Asian? Are you Pacific Rim? if you were to categorize yourself, how would you categorize yourself, and can you tell me why you categorize yourself in this way?
Well, I'm Korean because my parents are Koreans, but that doesn't make me any less a Korean. And although I was born in Hawaii, so I'm an American citizen. I'm glad that I have the citizenship. However, I still can't get away from the fact that I'm a Korean. And when they ask me, I say, I am a Korean. I don't deny the fact that I'm a Korean. In fact, I've been called everything else but Korean. The Koreans in Korea wouldn't believe 1946 that I was a Korean, because they said that even my Korean, I sound like a Chinese. My pronunciation was Chinese. And when I was a little boy, my nickname was Pake, which is Chinese, because I looked like a Chinese. And when I was in the army, they called me everything from Mexican to Filipino, and Japanese, Chinese, but not Korean. I was never mistaken for Korean, because we don't have, in fact, most of my family doesn't have that Korean features on our face for some reason. But I know I must be Korean because I look like my father. And my father is, and I was born from my mother, so I am a Korean, period.
There are activities going on around our nation which indicates the importance of being an ethnic. For instance, the Native Indians have their enclave with their activities as well as their rights and the perpetuation of their culture. Are you satisfied with what the Koreans are doing in America?
There are limits to what we can do in America because of the fact that regardless of what they say, they still have that strong prejudice against anything not white, non-white. And one of the things that I found was that the Korean civilization is much older than any European civilization. I went to museums when I was in Korea and I found that they were making vases that the Japanese claim is Japanese vases, but the Koreans made it about 5,000 years before Christ. And next to the Chinese, the Korean civilization is the oldest. When Korea was making all kinds of stuff in the 5,000 years before Christ, the Europeans were living in caves. They weren't even civilized, where the Koreans and Chinese were civilized. They had their own civilization. The only thing was that Koreans and Chinese, they had so much fighting among themselves that they never improved or advanced any further than they did. But they were so much ahead before Christ that you wouldn't believe it, but my mother used to tell me this. The Koreans invented the submarine.
For the Japanese to use?
No. They invented the submarine. What they did was when the Japanese military navy came into Korea, the Koreans, they had this thing that went underwater and they attach explosive to the Japanese ships. And everything was done underwater. And that was the first submarine.
Are there any other things that your parents have told you about Korea, like what you just mentioned about the submarines, that have remained with you, that you always remember that your parents have told you about their home?
No, not, I can't think of any right now, not offhand, anyway. But they should, well, being the only boy, my father used to sit me on his lap many times and tell me stories about Korea. And the only thing is, I can't remember all of them that he's told me about. Now, one thing that stands out is the fact that he says, don't you ever forget that you're an Andong Kim. In other words, from the Andong clan of the Kims.
And that is of the highest upper class.
It's one of the upper class, yes.
One of the upper yeah. class of the Yongbans.
Yeah, Yongbans.
Which are the
Korean
scholars.
Yeah.
Then you do have that heritage that you indicate makes you Korean. And you do have something your father has asked you never to forget.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The only thing is, like everything else, you know, if you don't use it, you don't get any benefits from it. Like, take for an example, a person can go to college, but if they don't use their knowledge that they gain from going to college, there's no sense in going to college. Because there's a lot of educated idiots in this world today.
Has your father expressed his unhappiness for not being able to use all of his scholarly knowledge to you? And if so, how did he show it?
No, he didn't.
He just self-contained it? And
yeah, he was too lazy. You know? He didn't want to do anything more. He was satisfied with what he had, and he just let it go at that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Do you have any final comments you would like to say about your life, both as Korean, both as American, and how perhaps the greatest impact your parents have made on your life and possibly upon the lives of your children?
Well, the only thing I can say is because of the fact that I didn't have any parental guidance when I was little, from the time I was 10 years old, I grew up doing things the way I wanted, and I was very ornery at times, and I did things a lot of times that was wrong. And I always felt that, you know, I was kind of strict with my children, because I always felt that children should be seen and not heard. And I was going overboard, but fortunately I had a wife that sort of tempered that with her own good-natured way of doing things. Like if I'd spank her, spank the kids, she'd go over and she'd console them, which was one of the reasons why I felt that I couldn't have married a better mother for my children. However, that's not saying anything too much, because being a good mother doesn't mean that you can be everything else. There's a lot of things that she has a lot of shortcomings also, like to all human beings.
Yes, we all can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
We will end this interview taping with Albert Kim. Albert, just a minute ago you were telling me about the time you found an uncle. Could you please tell me about that, how it is that you found your uncle and the treatment you received when you were there?
The address I had was old, so even the police didn't know where that was, because after the war everything had changed.
And that was in Korea?
That was in Korea, in Seoul. And when I was about ready to give up, I was going back to the jeep to go back to the to where I stayed in Korea, and I see this whole big bunch of people coming over, and it was my uncle. He had heard that I was there looking for him, and he knew who I was. He called me by name, by my Korean name, and he had his sons and daughters and stuff, and they took me over to the house, and they treated me like a king. It was a hot summer day, so what they did was they got some cool water from the well, soap and towel, and soaked the towel in the cold water and put it on the wrist and on the back of the neck, and that made me cool. And then they peeled the fruits, apples and stuff, and they cut it into bite size, put little forks on it, and my cousins, the girls, fed me. I didn't even have to lift up the fork. They put it in my mouth and I ate. After they got through with that, my aunt, my uncle's wife, and brought a table, small little table where we sat on the floor, full of food. And just my uncle and I sat there and ate. There was no women eating with us. And the women were around to help us, to serve us, but they weren't there to eat with us. And I guess that was a Korean custom.
Do you think it's because of the status your father had that your uncle was treating you as if you were of such a high status, high leveled scholar status?
No, it's a Korean custom where the oldest son of the oldest son perpetuates a family name and is supposed to take care of the family. And eventually I found out that my uncle wanted me to assume my responsibilities because I was the oldest son of the oldest son, which was my father, and we were supposed to get the family, take care of the family. But I said, nuts to hell, I didn't want to stay in Korea, it was too hot.
Well, I certainly find that contributory to attitudes that are different between your generation and that of the generations that preceded you in Korea. And I thank you for this contribution.
Oh, there's another thing I can add. While I was in Korea, one of the girls that worked in our office was an Ewha College graduate. And I met her father, who was a doctor, and her mother, who was a professor at Ewha College. And eventually I went over to the house and I asked the father if I could get married to the daughter. And the father told me, if you can stand her, you can have her. And, well, the only thing that prevented me from getting married to her was the fact that I was hurt in Korea. And the army had a system whereby if you stayed in the hospital for more than 3 months, they'd send you home to the hospital closest to your home, and they sent me back to Tripler. So when I came back to Tripler, I met the woman I eventually got married to. And when I got married to her, I wrote to the girl in Korea was writing to me, and when I answered the letter, I told her I was married, and that was the last I heard from her. She never answered me after that.
So that's how you broke your tie, your final tie to Korea.
There was, because after the Korean War, when I went back to Korea, I went over to where her house used to stand. There was only a big hole. Must have been bombed out. And it was a... There's been many times I went back to look for her, but could never find her. Anyway, eventually I found out from one of her former classmates, a doctor's wife, who I found out knew this girl, said that she wasn't married yet. She was in the Korean consulate in Paris. and she was always thought of in her class as the first one to get married, but she wasn't. She was still not married in 1972.
Well, I thank you very, very much for your major contribution to this oral history interview. Thank you.